difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Tosh Robinson
and Keith Phipps.
And once again, we are joined by a Sylvester Stallone scholar and gymnastics martial arts enthusiast, Matt Singer. Welcome back, Matt.
Thank you. It's great to be back and referred to as a gymnastics martial arts enthusiast. I've been waiting my whole life to be introduced that way.
I cannot imagine why. Why exactly that nomenclature? What is there some specific martial arts something that involves gymnastics that you're a fan of or an enthusiast for?
Not that I can think of, but if you can think of something, I would love to hear about it.
I mean, the only martial arts gymnastics thing of any kind I can think of is Gymkata. Oh. And I'm not... Do you have any sort of association with that?
Oh, Jim what, you say?
Oh, I look forward to the...
What is the country in which gymnastics martial arts is popular?
Parmistan, obviously. The nation, the great nation of Parmistan. I hear their chicken Parmistan is particularly delicious.
Oh man, we were discussing a little bit off pod about the troubling lack of availability of a high quality Blu-ray or
there's no Blu-ray, there's no HD print. I've had film theaters come to me and say, you know, like, we'd like to, you know, would you want to come introduce it if we can get a copy of it? And I'm like, absolutely not. I don't care for that motion picture. Please don't ask me again. But they persist. And it turned like no one can find a copy of it. Like, theoretically, you could show the old DVD, I guess. But they're like, it is unavailable for consumption in a theater, which is a travesty, a tragedy of cinema. But
I mean, if you're not watching it in 4K, are you going to be able to experience either the thrill of gymnastics or the kill of karate?
Not the way it was intended by Robert Klaus, the director of Enter the Dragon and Gymkata. You make a great point. I think for the good of us all, someone needs to really take charge here and solve this problem.
Wow.
It's really an interesting career, isn't it? Looking at his filmography, because that's...
what are we doing? We can't do this.
We should be recording this.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Gymkata podcast about Gymkata.
I could feel like Genevieve Kosky somewhere just being, what are you doing? Please find some direction here.
This is where we make connections between Creed 3 and Gymkata, correct? That's what I was told when I agreed to do this podcast.
They're both movies.
We're not doing it. I'm drawing the line. All right. We're talking about boxing here. We're not going to talk about gymnastics, martial arts.
Fine.
So last week we discussed Rocky 3, a second sequel in which Sylvester Stallone's underdog southpaw is now a rich, pampered heavyweight champ and has to return to his roots in order to triumph in the ring. In Creed 3, Adonis Donnie Creed's roots wind up returning to him. Much like Rocky Balboa in Rocky 3, Michael B. Jordan's Donnie is an obscenely wealthy and highly regarded world champion with a supportive wife, played by Tessa Thompson, and a deaf daughter that he tends to closely. Donnie has retired from the ring, but he's pulled back into the life when Damian Anderson, an old friend from his group home days, resurfaces after a long prison stint. Creed feels responsible for the incident that landed Dame, as he calls him, in jail and short-circuited his career, and Dame, played by Jonathan Majors, appears to hold that opinion too, turning to Creed for the resources to revive his boxing ambitions. But despite his guilt, Creed doesn't initially grasp the depth of his friend's resentment, and their dispute eventually has to be solved in a ring in the middle of Dodger Stadium. We'll fight it out amongst ourselves after the break.
I spent the last 7 years of my life living out my wildest dreams. Bianca, Rocky, my dad. This is built on their shoulders.
Hey, my man, can I help you?
Let me get an autograph.
Nah, I ain't signing an autograph, but you get off my car.
You don't remember me, huh?
Damien.
How long were you locked up?
18 years, bro. Just got out last week.
Glad to have you back out, huh?
I know I've been away a long time, but I kept myself in shape. I still got gas in the tank.
Come by the gym.
Thank you.
Curious what happened with you two?
I didn't tell you.
We was like brothers.
I was the best, though. But I never got a chance to prove that.
That's cute.
I know what you're doing, Donnie.
You don't owe this dude nothing. Damien's fighting the world, and he's trying to hurt people.
I vouch for you. You think you mad? Try spending half your life in a cell. Watching somebody else live your life. I'm coming for everything.
You threatening me?
Okay, so I'm curious. I kind of know what everyone thinks about this, but Tasha. So I really want to know, Tasha, first, what did you think of Creed 3?
I think this film may have been a little oversold to me as like the second coming of Christ plus a bag of orgasms all covered with chocolate ganache. So I think I may be...
Who sold you it like that?
A bunch of people who saw it early just really, really praised it to the skies. I more or less thought it was okay in terms of, I really am enjoying listening to Michael B. Jordan talk about his directorial choices and bringing in his influences, especially bringing in anime and how much he absolutely adores anime and the particular kind of ways of like a certain brand of anime uses to express heartfelt emotions through stylization and people hitting each other or zapping each other or, you know, hadoukening each other, however you wish to put it. But for the most part, I thought it was okay as a boxing story and okay as a family drama. Okay to maybe not great as a family drama. What really got me, what hooked me and kept me was the energy between Jordan and Jonathan Majors, who, I mean, Jonathan Majors is really having a year between this and everything he's doing with the MCU. He's very front and centered. And when he first appeared in the movie, I was like, might be a little burned out on this guy who's just spent so much time on screens lately. But he really brings a soulfulness to this role that makes the resentment very understandable, like palpable, but also layered. And both of these men just give performances that I think enliven this movie past the relatively simple structure of Rocky III, basically. You know, it's more or less guy is on top of the world, guy gets beat, guy needs to find his hunger and come back and be on top of the world again. It's a very simple logline. I think a lot of what makes Creed 3 work for me is in the performances and in just kind of some of the grace notes of the story rather than in some of the bigger, broader strokes. With the outcome of the big central fight never in doubt and the outcome of the first central fight never in doubt, it just really becomes about how you do it as people more than anything else. So I ended up thinking this movie was entirely okay. And when it's great because of the people, not necessarily because of the material or the approach.
Yeah, pretty much with you, Tasha. I really love the first Creed. And
yes, agreed.
And Creed 2, I think, is also very good. I thought this was fine. You know, it is... There's a lot to like about it. I think Jordan's a really promising director visually. I think he's obviously really good with actors. And I think he and Majors and Tessa Thompson are all really good. But I felt just as a story, it feels, you know, not streamlined enough. It's kind of clunky and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really quite, you know, move the way you want it to. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but I feel like the narratively convenient death in this movie feels a lot more forced than the one in Rocky III. I don't know. I wanted to like it more, but you know, it's not a huge disappointment, but I think it's the weakest of the three Creed films so far.
Matt, you're grimacing. You like this one?
I guess I probably liked it the best out of everyone here. I mean, I think some of the complaints that have already been mentioned are totally fair. I think the reason that I really enjoyed it, like Tasha, was I just was a very engaged by the Jonathan Majors, Michael B. Jordan relationship, their performance together, their work together in the ring, out of the ring. I just thought they were a very well-matched pair. And, you know, all the stuff involving those characters, with maybe the exception of the way some of the flashbacks are deployed and the pace that, at which they're deployed, mm-hmm. I thought was really, I just was very interested in that relationship. And is it surprising or shocking where it goes? No, absolutely not. But I mean, I don't really go to a Rocky/Creed movie to be surprised or shocked. Like to some extent, I'm going to see these, you know, well-tested motifs and themes and ideas kind of get, you know, updated and sort of played with one more time in a new context. And I felt like I got exactly what I sort of came to get out of it. And I do not think it's as good as the first Creed, which I agree is definitely the best of the three and probably is the best movie in the whole franchise, minus the original Rocky. But I would certainly say this is, to me, it was as enjoyable as Creed 2 and maybe a little bit better for me. And I guess the reason I would say that is, like, I did, you know, as someone who you've called me several times like a Stallone scholar or whatever, which I never would claim that title. Gymnastics martial arts enthusiast, that title I would claim. But a Stallone scholar, I mean, I would never, like, consider myself that, even though I do find him an interesting filmmaker and actor and movie star especially. But, like, I would have thought I would be going the whole movie, like, where's Rocky? Why isn't Rocky a part of this? Like, there should be Rocky, you know, like, almost
where's
like a Poochie.
Poochie.
It's like a Poochie thing, like, you know, where everyone should be talking about Poochie when he's not on screen. And I really actually felt like they did a really successful job of sort of making a Creed movie where, other than maybe one or two minor moments, it did not feel like he was missing or there was an element missing. And I did sort of like the way that it didn't feel like a Rocky sequel at times, whereas Creed 2 very much felt like a Rocky sequel, like, for better or worse. And this one, I felt like, yes, it has a lot of the same, you know, the expected tropes and stuff. But I don't know, I did feel like Michael B. Jordan was kind of, you know, like, living up to all the scenes in that gym where there's a big sign on the wall that says, like, build your own legacy, where I felt like he was kind of at least attempting to put his stamp on this franchise. And I appreciated that about it.
I gotta say, I cannot think of a single place in this narrative where Rocky would have fit. Like, this is fundamentally a story about two young black men who came from a very poor and troubled background and ended up taking different paths through what amounts to an accident of fate. And they ended up in different places when they could have ended up in the same place. And then they have to reconcile with that, both of them. One of them has to reconcile with his anger and the other has to reconcile with his guilt. And I am really glad that they didn't try to make room for an old white guy to show up and tell him how to do it. You know, to tell either of them how to navigate their lives or this very, very personal relationship that they have. I think that this series has definitely moved beyond Stallone. And inserting him back into it over and over, like, as a mentor, like, if this movie had a scene where he showed up and tried to give advice and Adonis said, like, this is something you don't know anything about, go away, it would have fit narratively, but it wouldn't have felt good for lovers of this franchise or lovers of Rocky in general. I think this was exactly the right amount of Stallone for this story, which is to say none.
Yeah, he's essential to the first movie, and it feels like you kind of shoehorned into the second one, although I like some of that. But yeah, you're right. It's fine without him. It has to move on.
We could maybe learn what the sign is for yo, though. We could have learned that from Uncle Rocky. So
it turns out that Adrian's name sign is just the sign for yo with an A stuck in the middle of it.
Yo. So I think I maybe someone on the lowest end here on this one. I was bored by this film for much of the way. I think the pacing of it is really turgid. It lacks juice. I like the juice, and the juice is good. And this does not have. I'm making an SNL reference that No one's gonna get it. Matt, of course, gets it, but maybe nobody else is gonna get the. I like it.
I'm just trying to avoid making jokes about how juicy these men are.
So it's like this film doesn't have the energy that I think it needs to have, and I think it really, really badly gets bogged down by the backstory part of it, and by the agonizingly slow reveal of what actually happened and who this guy was and what happened at the end of the of this fateful scene at the liquor store. I felt like all of that was just the classic example of Noel Murray's Band the Backstory piece that we ran in the Dissolve. It was just like really hit that. And I think, you know, to me, the movie really popped with Jonathan Majors. Like, Jonathan Majors was what this film is missing for the most part. I mean, like, that kind of energy that he almost kind of has, a sort of rascally quality to him. I mean, there's a certain amount of pain that he is carrying, that his character is carrying into this situation. But there's also just a lot of, like, there's braggadocio and sort of a trolly nature to him as well. There's something kind of, he's a wild card. And I think the film really needs that desperately, and more of it, and less of a lot of the stuff that I think slows it down. I think it finds itself in the finale, which the final fight is quite entertaining. You know, it's expected, it's the obligatory thing, but it's well executed. And I think there's some, you know, solid directorial chops at play here from Jordan, especially for a first time filmmaker. I was bored, I have to admit I was not as engaged by this film as I wanted to be, which is kind of the issue I had with Creed 2. But I found that it's a lot of the drama in that, particularly involving Dolph Lundgren's character, to kind of get past sort of the problems with that. I miss sort of the dynamism that Ryan Coogler brought to the first Creed. It needs to have punch, for lack of a better word.
Boo.
Wait, is that boo for the opinion or for the dad joke?
For the dad joke. Yeah, the opinion is fine. Okay. He's allowed to not like it, but the punching thing,
I didn't realize I was making some sort of pun there.
That somehow makes it even worse. Pun.
Yep.
I mean, I can see. I mean, we definitely agree about the flashbacks and how they're deployed. I do think they kind of stop the momentum of a movie that doesn't have a ton of, like, propulsive momentum to begin with. And I sort of understand, I think, what Michael B. Jordan was going for with the way that they're sort of so carefully, like, stretched out, in terms of, like, it's not just one big chunk at the beginning. It's like we keep having these little glimpses and drips and drabs. And I think the idea is that, you know, and I think Adonis even kind of talks about this in the movie, is like, he has basically buried all of this trauma and this, and when Dame returns to his life, it's basically like bringing it back up over and over again. And he can't, you know, he's worked so hard kind of to avoid this. And avoid all of this stuff that happened. And now it's like he can't escape it. And so the movie can't escape it too. So I think, like, I get that. And I think it's that's a totally, like, valid way of approaching it. I think I do think, though, we as the audience are sitting here going, we know exactly what this story is going to be. And it basically is what I at least expected. Like, there's not a lot of surprises there. So the way that it's sort of stretched out, it's like when you get to the end here, it's not like there's some shocking revelation. It does just seem like he's kind of telling the story we expect in a way that is, yeah, it does kind of prolong it in a way that maybe isn't as sort of satisfying if what you're looking for is the punching, as Scott said. I guess the thing that I found, you know, I did not find this movie turgid or boring. I guess what I found really engaging and interesting was just the Dame character and the way, you know, I already said, well, I don't expect to be surprised by a Rocky movie or a Creed movie now. But on the flip side of that, like, I did feel like my sort of expectations for this sort of character, the Dame character, were kind of subverted a little bit in that, you know, especially by Rocky III, the villains in these movies became, you know, very two-dimensional. You know, like Clubber Lang, we talked about him on the previous episode. He's just all intensity and rage, and we never find out where any of that comes from, or we can infer certain things, but there's not a single scene where that even sort of brings any of that up. And here, you know, the Dane character we spend a lot of time with. We see his apartment, which looks a lot like Rocky's apartment from the very first Rocky movie. You know, and he has stuff hanging on his bathroom wall, just like Rocky did. You know, like in this movie, he is kind of the Rocky figure. And that sort of automatically makes Adonis the Creed figure. And so I found that dynamic and playing with that very interesting. You know, someone already said, the ending is a formality and all that, which is totally fair. But what was different for me was I didn't entirely know who I wanted to win this fight. Like, I was kind of rooting for Dame at a certain point. You know, there's like one or two scenes right before the fight where they sort of, I think they almost make a tactical error and kind of betray the character. And he goes kind of full heel for a moment or two. He becomes like a little more overtly like, I'm going to beat you up, basically, you know, and I've been tricking you all along. And he almost does like an evil laugh. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like if you take that stuff out, you really would not know who necessarily you would want to win that fight. And that was the stuff that was the juice, Scott. That was the juice
he's
of
got,
the movie.
He's got his beef is legit, I think.
Yeah.
With Creed. I mean, I think Creed does have a pretty solid reason to feel pretty guilty about a lot of that stuff. I mean, that, so
yes,
there's that. And then there's an interesting kind of sensitive side to it, the masculine side, that I guess maybe we'll get into connections. But I did want to share, related to that, a tweet I read today from a critic named Barry Hertz from Toronto, who said men will literally drag airplanes on their backs in training montages instead of going to therapy. And I feel like that is really good. And it's very fascinating to me to kind of see that element of just of reflection of that takes place of what men need to do to resolve some of the emotional problems they carry on. It almost makes you think too that if this film could either eliminate or severely limit the flashbacks, it would be something. It would be tighter. I mean, I hate to give advice. I mean, I'm not a filmmaker, but it does feel like that's where I'll just say that that's where the film gets dragged down, and that's where you feel really stuck in the mud is when you're really kind of keep circling back to this night and to this moment and to this past, and it's not. You know, and it the way it sort of teases all that stuff out, it's just like, I mean, well, you know, Rocky 3 is not even 90 minutes long. This is 2 hours, you know, and you feel it. You feel
Rocky 3 is 100 minutes long, but yeah, your point taken. But yeah, I actually
Rocky 3 is 100 minutes?
Rocky 4 is the one that's under 90 minutes, and and like 10 minutes of it is Rocky 3 just replayed.
I do think though that the opening flashback is one of the best scenes in the movie. It's almost like, if they kind of like just confine it to that again, like, yeah, like you, I'm not a screenwriter or a filmmaker, but I was really gripped by it at that point. It's just every time I returned to it, it became an issue.
Yeah, those two teenage boys, Thaddeus J. Mixon and Spence Moore II, first of all, they're uncanny ringers for what these two men would later look like. It's so easy to look at them and see the men that those characters are going to be later, to see these recognizable movie stars in their faces. I'm presuming and I'm hoping that this wasn't a CG effect, and there wasn't any trickery involved. They just cast people who really not only look like them, but get their mannerisms right. You know, the kid playing the young version of Michael B. Jordan gets the smile right. You know, the little sort of shy, smirky smile that creeps across his face. The kid doing the young version of Jonathan Majors does that kind of poochy thing that he does with his lips when he's like feeling contempt in a scenario. Like, there's just a lot of little mannerisms in there that are really recognizable, and they have really good chemistry with each other as friends. I would heartily support a version of this movie that just lets that whole scene play out so here's what's happened, and then communicates the Adonis can't get these moments out of his head, like through flashbacks that are just like a couple seconds long, literally just, you know, we see him experiencing distress and then we just get this tiny little flash letting us know he's reliving it again and again and again, and he can't get out of it. But I think Matt's exactly right in that the way it plays out is as though the movie is withholding information that's going to be some kind of like big twist, that's going to be a reveal, that's going to change the dynamic somehow. And that never happens. You know, we eventually see what we've already been told happened. And by the time we see it on screen, it's like, yeah, I know you told the story. Why are we waiting and seeing it play out at length? So I agree that it's both a pacing issue and a kind of a structural issue. I like the theme of the trauma resurfacing and becoming inescapable. But I think the way that the story is told kind of hampers the movie. And also, I just kind of think that the moment Dame reappears, knowing what that story is and like knowing why Adonis carries around this guilt, becomes important, because there's so much nuance between them, you know, and there's so many things that they're sort of trying to play off in their persona, that they're pretending things are okay. They're pretending they're still old friends. They're pretending nothing has changed. And then it becomes clear that that's not true. And Dame is pretending he doesn't need a handout. He's pretending he doesn't need help. But we come to see that that's not true. And he's pretending he's less resentful and jealous and bitter than he is. And we come to see that that's not true. And all of these things come out in their performances. But like knowing what the source is from the start, I think would make that all more trackable and more powerful, instead of playing it like it's something that we need to discover and like we're supposed to be shocked when we get there.
So one thing that is curious to me is sort of the general relationship between the Creed franchise and the Rocky franchise. And I think one of the things that the Creed movies seem to be fighting against is kind of the pulpiness and the sort of vulgarity of the Rocky movies, particularly, well, anything after the first one, really, but like there is an attempt to kind of do something a little bit more serious, a little more muted, a little bit more character driven than what we saw in those original Rocky movies. I mean, do you all have the same kind of read on it as I do? Or
I mean, this does really feel like a Rocky III remake, just more sophisticated, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, we'll find out in the connection, certainly.
More just like sort of generally the more grounded tone of this than the Rocky sequels?
So. I mean, I just think there's a way to just like, okay, we've got to do this. You know, we're part of this kind of world that Stallone has created. But, you know, I mean, we talked about the absence of Stallone completely from this one and this need to kind of create your own legend or whatever. I think that's been something that's been happening from the start, even with the first Creed, of just like trying to figure out how to be a Rocky movie without being a Rocky movie.
I do think the second Creed 2 definitely felt, which Stallone did have a writing credit on, did feel much more like a Rocky sequel in terms of that pulpiness or that vulgarity or however you want to describe it. I mean, that was a movie about a guy trying to avenge his father's death by boxing the son of the guy who killed his dad. Like, and this movie is much more like a two-hander character drama between these two men who have this incredibly intense connection and this very complicated relationship and past. And, you know, like the Rocky sequel of Creed 3 would be like, well, he's Clubber Lang's nephew or something like that. There would have to be some sort of familial, you know, it wouldn't just be he's just a guy that grew up with Donnie. There would have to be a grander design to that tapestry. So, yes, I do think that it is trying to do something at least different from the Rocky sequels, especially the later Rocky sequels. I mean, we already talked about some of the ways that it's different. Like the pacing you know, it's a 2-hour movie versus by Rocky IV. Like, it literally is like an 85-minute movie where the first 10 minutes are Rocky III, and then there's like 6 montages. Like, there's like the number of like actual scenes with a beginning, middle, and end with dialogue in that movie are tiny. It's kind of unbelievable when you watch it today. So this is very, yes, it's absolutely very different than that. And again, like, and the treatment of the villain is so different, where I'm talking about, I wonder if he should maybe, I'm rooting for him in that fight. Like, yes, there are some interesting things that you can sort of read into the Clubber Lang character, but I have a hard time going, man, I hope Clubber Lang beats Rocky. He's, you know, take that, Italian Stallion. Like, that, I don't think that we're really meant to in that movie. So that's a difference as well. And I do think, like, I haven't watched Creed 2, you know, in a couple of years. I would be very interested to watch it and this back to back and just see how different or how similar they do feel. Because at least in my mind, they feel quite different.
There was never a moment in Creed 3 where I thought, you know, I really want to see Adonis get beat down, or Adonis really deserves to get beat down, or Adonis really deserves to lose this fight. But am I alone in having an experience towards the middle of that fight of wondering whether Adonis was going to throw it? Like, there was a point for me, I think it was Scott was talking about not necessarily being positive who was going to win that fight. I was positive who could win that fight, but I was not. I would not have been entirely shocked if Adonis had made the decision that, like, what he owed his friend was to give him closure in the sense of winning this fight and remaining heavyweight champion of the world. Like, the question running throughout this movie is, what do I owe this guy? I escaped and he didn't, but so much of that is, you know, about systemic racism in America and not about me personally. Like, how far do I owe my success that I worked hard for to this guy who wasn't there and was only there for me in childhood? Like, ultimately, I did kind of wonder if he was going to throw not full on throw the fight, but, like, I don't know, lose the eye of the tiger, lose the hunger, like, because he didn't necessarily have a hunger to beat Damien the way Damien had a hunger to beat him. And if he had decided to let that fight go because it was what Damien needed, that would not have been a surprising result for me thematically. Am I wrong? Am I alone here?
I think what does it often make that impossible is the fact that Damien is, you know, plays dirty to get there. By hiring someone to attack Victor Drago, who can then fight Felix, it's a cheat.
And he's a dirty fighter too.
He's a dirty fighter with Felix in the ring too. And like I was, I think one thing, you know, this is obviously a long movie already, but I felt like a little shortchanged by all the drama about, you know, Creed's responsibility for Felix, you know, getting really, you know, beat hard in a fight that he shouldn't have been in the first place. In the ring, and then, like, by the end, Felix and his family are by, you know, with Creed's family, like, you know, all was forgiven in a scene deleted or something. I'm not sure.
I think maybe the most mesmerizing sequence for me in the entire film is when Dame is fighting that first fight, and he's fighting dirty, and it's clear to me, at least in that sequence, that he doesn't really see anything wrong with what he's doing. Like, the smile on his face after the face elbow business seems just almost innocent, like, just very open, like the glee of a little kid who's winning a checkers game. You know, it's not, I am going to vindictively cheat and hurt you so I can go murder this other guy who I'm angry at. It's, I'm winning the game. And the fact that he's doing it by fighting dirty, just, you know, it's kind of how he came up. It's maybe the result of 18 years in prison and doing whatever he had to do. And that choice, like the way Jonathan Majors plays that sequence, to me is one of the most interesting things in the film and maybe one of the most daring, because I don't think that scene plays him like an irredeemable villain. It plays him like a poor sportsman and a very dangerous person to be in the ring with and a dishonest person, but not as evil, more as just unaware of how what he's doing is playing to literally everyone else around him. And as the mood of the fight changes as everybody who's watching him gets more and more horrified and upset with what's going on. And he's still grinning that like little kid who winning a checkers game grin. It's just so clear to me that like he's not fighting the fight that everybody is expecting him to fight. He's not having the experience anybody thinks that he's having. And maybe that's one of the reasons Adonis is so taken aback and horrified by that fight. Is like he's seeing a different side of his friend, but he's also seeing something he just really doesn't have the tools to fix at all.
Yeah. The idea of, you know, Adonis out of guilt or whatever sort of throwing the final fight or sort of letting Dame win, that hadn't crossed my mind, but it's an interesting sort of alternative universe to ponder. And I think Keith is right in that the way that they structured the movie, where he sort of like he kind of reveals his evilness in that, you know, in those one or two scenes right before the big fight, sort of makes it so I feel like they couldn't have done it. But if they had sort of tweaked those scenes or removed that part, it's an interesting way they could have gone with it, and not necessarily an unsatisfying one. But then perhaps you couldn't make Creed 4. You'd have to make Anderson 2 or something like that. Like, it's almost like he really does become like the other protagonist in a way, if he's gonna, you know, and it's like almost like the redemption of Dame or something like that, which I mean isn't, given the journey the Rocky movies have been on, is not an outlandish concept for another one of these movies. I mean, I would fully expect if there was like a Creed 4, you know, that there would have to be like the Apollo-esque face turn, the way in Rocky 3 Apollo becomes his buddy. Like, it would seem inevitable that Dame would sort of become his trainer or something. You know, like these things almost write themselves at this point.
Yeah, you could train him to fight Tommy Gunn's son.
There we go.
Yes. I mean, just holding this Rocky 5 reference, just it's been in the bag.
Rocky Jr., Milo Ventimiglia has to come and challenge him. I mean, come on, that's the only acceptable ending here.
Oh my God. Craziness. Well, let's leave it at that. We've got tons of connections to make here between Creed 3 and Rocky 3. There's something about that second sequel. They just have to do it a certain way. So we'll do that after the break.
Is there something else you want to tell me? Dee, you have got to open up at some point. I don't know what else to tell you. I need to understand what is going on.
What you want to hear? Some sad story? You trying to feel sorry for me or something?
No, I don't want to feel sorry for you. I want to understand you. I want to know what is going on with you in my house.
I don't want to talk about anything. I've been trying to forget it. It's dead. Leave it. Let it lie. I'm not talking about that shit no more.
So now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. And one of the things they have in common are the certain important character deaths of people who are in poor health. We have Mickey, Rocky's trainer, and then we have Marianne, who is Adonis's mother. So how do these narratively convenient deaths play out, Keith?
You know, I brought up the idea that it works better in Rocky 3 than in Creed 3. But the more I think about it, like, they're both pretty kind of awkwardly telegraphed in both movies. You know, I'm not sure. Maybe it's because, maybe it's just because Burgess Meredith looks so much closer to death in what's the shot. You know, it feels like it comes like we're out of the blue when Marion and Creed dies, and the whole business about her other kids not being there. I don't know. It just felt a little bit like this needs to happen now to motivate Creed for the final act. Well, maybe Mickey's death, you know, coming earlier makes a difference. I'm not sure. But, you know, I'm not exactly sure why. I did find the funeral sequence in Rocky III quite moving in a way that maybe this is it. I felt that whole scene, like, really quite moving. And you can see the impact it has on Rocky, whereas in Creed III, the death is sad and it's well played by both Michael B. Jordan and Felicia Rashad, but then it's kind of forgotten, you know, if I'm unless I'm misremembering the movie.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it comes back up. And it also feels maybe a little too narratively convenient in that it robs Adonis of any chance at closure. Like, he has his own reasons to be angry in this film, to complicate all of his other emotions that he's battling with. He deserves to be really, really angry at her for cutting this person out of his life. This person that needed him and cared for him and took care of him and was an important part of his life. She just consciously made the decision to not pass on Dame's letters and to make him think that, you know, Dame wasn't reaching out to him. And she robbed Dame of like and potentially a really important part of the rest of his youth. As a result, she like destroyed this relationship. And Adonis doesn't really get a chance to be mad about it. You know, he walks away from her, but then he gets no closure because you can't necessarily expect closure out of somebody who's dying and somebody who in their final scene keeps calling him by his father's name and just clearly really isn't all there. And that to me was a little frustrating. It's perhaps very realistic to acknowledge that sometimes your parents do terrible things and sometimes you're not going to get closure and sometimes lives end before all the loose ends are wrapped up. But in a movie this programmatic, to do something like that to this guy and then say, and you're never going to get any resolution for it or any apology. She's just going to say, yep, that's what I did. And then keel over dead. Rude.
You know, as I'm listening, there's another connection here, which is that Mickey has been withholding information from Rocky, too. He's been setting him up with these fights where he can easily win. He's been protecting him, you know, that in a that. There's a symmetry there as well. They are both very...
Oh, you're right.
They are both very narratively convenient. I will say the telegraphing of Mickey is, I think, handled a little more gracefully just because it's like, well, he's just acting like he's unwell. He looks, as Keith said, he doesn't look like the healthiest guy. And then he's sort of like, he's like grimacing during the Thunderlip sequence.
It's my heart.
Yeah, exactly. But in Creed 3, they literally have a scene where they're like, now, mom, you know, you've been having these strokes.
I know.
That this couldn't possibly come up later at an inopportune time in the story.
Gigantic glass of wine. You should be drinking that gigantic glass of wine because you just had a stroke.
Yeah, and I think
gigantic glasses of wine are good for your heart.
So that, I mean, when that scene is going on, you're like, oh, okay, well, she's going to have another stroke. She's going to die. She's like, it's impossible not to predict all that. I think the other big sort of issue is I think the Marianne Creed character is a very interesting idea for that character. But I don't know that she ever really had a ton of really like memorable scenes throughout all of these movies, you know, like whereas the Rocky and Mickey relationship, we can think of all these moments that they had and like the and just so like when that character dies, that really like that's a real gut punch. And I'm sorry to try to outdo Scott's terrible dad joke from before.
Oh, what?
But, I mean, it really is like you really feel that where in this movie, it's, you know, it's sad, but it's like that character has not had the same sort of impact on the overarching, you know, story of the overall franchise in the same way. And so it does feel more like, well, if we have this person die, it will serve the story and the motivations of Donnie and will, you know, and it will further this, as opposed to being like, well, this is a very emotional sequence into and of itself. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, she dies for the convenience part is that she's martyred for us to feel more sympathy for him in a sense that like her character is so responsible for this ruined relationship that he has with this, you know, this dude. Like, you know, if Adonis had said, you know what, I'm going to cut this person out of my life. I'm going to ignore these letters. I'm not going to pay attention. I need to move on with my life. I can't be held down by this guy. If he had made those decisions for himself, then we're really testing the audience's sympathy for him in a serious way. For the fact that he was sort of betrayed / protected by his mother that's the real convenience here. I think.
Well, let's be real about that. He did actually make the choice to not ever go check up on his friend, to not communicate with
but
his
all
friend.
The
he
way.
Could have gone there, and he when he makes the apology, I think it's very telling and adult that he does not bring up, like, he has already said, I did not get your letters. He doesn't try to insert, it turned out my mom was hiding them all along, into the narrative of his apology. He doesn't try to deflect it. He just says, I didn't come and see you, and that's on me, and I'm sorry. So, you know, good for him. But at the same time, like, he didn't ignore Damien's letters, but he did ignore Damien. He did make that choice.
I'm kind of interested. I mean, this is another connection related to that relationship about masculinity and about feelings and about how these kind of men relate to each other. The whole thing about being, you know, men rather dragging a jet than going into therapy. There is an interesting kind of a therapy angle, particularly in Creed 3, but we also mentioned it in Rocky 3 too, about these feelings being out in the open and how they need to be resolved. And what the interesting kind of turn in Creed 3 is that Creed's wife, played by Tessa Thompson, doesn't understand why he's not being open with her. And then there's a certain point where it kind of clicks for her, and she kind of understands, like, oh, you need to actually do this. In order to kind of like solve some of these problems that you have, you need to go and fight again. And I support that idea. That's kind of interesting. I mean, considering how deep into feelings and almost therapeutized thoughts this movie is, that a lot of things need to be worked out in this really physical way.
Sort of linking that back to the deaths thing, I think one of the reasons Mickey's death works more emotionally than Marianne's is because it's so tied into the theme of Rocky III about aging and eventually having to give up on certain things because your body's going to break down. Like, Mickey giving up the ghost is heavily foreshadowed and ties into, like, Rocky's own feelings of, you know, getting weaker and people coming up behind him and wanting what he has. With Marianne's death, it just seems a lot less part of the thematic structure of the movie. But to the degree that it does tie in, it ties in that sense of the question of, like, who you open up to about your emotions, when you open up, whether you're capable of opening up. Because it kind of feels like her death is part of what pushes Adonis to the point where he can actually talk about what he experienced. You know, his sense of loss and his sense of grief are big enough that he reaches a point where he does have to express his emotions. I just think it's funny and kind of enjoyable that in both of these movies, it's their wives that need to talk them out of being a big emotionally withholding, like, stolid hunks of rock. And, you know, both of their wives are just like, you have to come out and express these emotions. But neither of them do it in a, like, a soft or therapeutic kind of way at all. Like, neither of them are being emotional women about it in the broad stereotypical sense. They're both just merciless, and they both come at these fighters as fighters themselves. You know, they both come at them with just like, you need to shut up and get your crap together, or you're going to fall apart. Like, they neither of them quite slap their men upside the head, but they do so verbally, and it turns out to be the right approach with both of these guys. It's like the only way they can express emotion is by shouting it after having been shouted at. You know, after being clubbed upside the head with what they're doing wrong, they can express emotions in a way that amounts to fighting back.
I mean, both movies have almost the exact same scene where, after withholding this burden, the boxer finally opens up to the wife, and the wife says, thank you for, you know, being honest with me. Now go beat that other guy up. I guess the difference is in Creed 3, like, there has to be like a second scene like that, but it's now between the two boxers, between the two men. Like, it's inconceivable of Rocky and Clubber after their fight having a little way to go champ kind of sequence. I mean, they wouldn't need to. There's no reason to in that movie. But in Creed 3, I'm really glad that scene is there, because the conflict doesn't feel resolved, actually. despite there being a winner in the fight, until they have that scene after the fight in the dressing room, the whatever, and they talk about the whole thing. Like, that's where it all gets resolved. So it's almost more touchy-feely, for lack of a better term, than even Rocky III was in that way.
Yeah, and, you know, despite the brief question of whether Adonis was going to throw the fight for Dame's emotional health and safety and security, I kind of felt like the fight was probably foreordained, but it also wasn't really the drama. You know, the drama was going to be, how do they talk to each other afterwards? What do they say? And how does Dame take it? Because that was going to be always going to be the big question. Like, Adonis was going to come to him and try to make amends in some way. But the question of, like, what Dame would say in response was maybe the biggest mystery in the movie for me. Like, the biggest, I don't know how this is going to play out. And I'm engaged in finding out how it plays out.
Do they really just need to be exhausted to be able to have this conversation? I mean, could they have found some other way? Could, like, running against each other on a beach and then talking in a locker room later about how they feel, like, they just need, or having a really tough workout? I mean, do they really have to punch each other in the middle of Dodger Stadium to get to that point?
They briefly thought about just, like, racing on the beach, but then they realized neither of them had an appropriate crop top to wear, and they had to scrap the whole
comparing thigh socks. Sizes, who has the bigger thighs or something.
Oh, bad. So what else? What else? What else about these two films?
Well, I'll bring up a comparison that it kind of is addressing the question that you just asked, Scott, which is this movie is just so much about guilt, about, you know, guilt over being a success, guilt over being rich, guilt over being Black in America, and having stepped up, like, past the level where that is a constant threat, you know, a constant existential threat. We talked about race to some degree in Rocky III, and I feel like Creed III takes a similar approach in that nobody ever gives a speech about being Black in America, but it hangs over the entire film. You know, the racial dynamics of a boy spending 18 years in jail for possession of a firearm, you know, which he did not use to hurt anybody. We don't know what his priors were, but we know that he didn't shoot anybody in that sequence. He just owned an illegal gun, and he ended up spending 18 years in jail for it. You know, he had his youth and his promise and his future taken away from him for defending his friend, albeit defending his friend in an illegal and questionable way. There's still just, you know, the incarceration of Black men in America is an idea that hangs over this movie. The question of, like, rising up out of poverty as a young Black male and becoming a rich success story and then trying to decide what you owe to other people hangs over this movie. So, but again, nobody gives a speech about it in terms of race at any point. The words aren't said, but the feeling is there. So I think it's interesting how much both of these films carry about, like, the weight and understanding of race in America without giving into, like, cheesy crash style explanations where people give speeches about it.
I've been just sitting and not even things that I had ever thought about before, because I'm almost like, as we're talking about the movie, and I'm thinking about how much I really liked, even despite some of the evil things he does, like, how much I like that Dame character and was really rooting for him in the movie. And I'm sort of picking apart my own feelings about him and why that was. And I'm and comparing it to Rocky III and the Rocky movies in general. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, obviously, if this movie is going to have anything besides a boxing match at the end, obviously, it's like a training montage. And I was trying to think if there's another training montage in the franchise where we see the opponent training. You know, the training montage is such, like, a mythic thing for Rocky and now Creed in these movies where we watch him getting strong now, gonna fly now. And, you know, like, that's the moment in every movie where, you know, it's like the signal that, like, you know, that it's about, we're about to get the big fight. But it's also like, that's like like a special thing just Rocky gets. You know what I mean? Like if the opponent shows up, it's like a brief fleeting glimpse.
You're right.
Yeah, Rocky 3 gives us a ton of clever.
Yeah, okay, never mind. I don't know what I'm talking about. I guess I'm wrong. I take it all back. I mean,
the emphasis is on Rocky.
I just think in this one, you're right. In Rocky IV, really, it's like the dichotomy between the two of them.
Right, exactly. Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. One is this kind of machine tool,
right,
representative
and
of.
And he's taking steroids, and Rocky, who I'm right, sure Sylvester Stallone has never taken steroids in his life, ever. He's, yeah, lifting farm implements and climbing mountains and stuff. You're right. I forgot that one. But I don't know. The fact that, again, like this one, you know, and it's not showing, well, this person is doing it the right way and this person is doing it the wrong way, which is how Rocky IV really plays.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
It's that these are like two equal opponents, and it's not necessarily this one is training the right way and this one is training the wrong way. It's more like these guys are both like ridiculously awesome athletes, and they're both in incredible shape, and they're both gonna beat the crap out of each other. I guess when I was watching it, I maybe was even subliminally going like, I don't know who I would rather want to see win here. I don't know. Maybe it's less novel now that you've pointed out that I was wrong about most of it. But I think in my heart, I was right in a more ecstatic truth level that Werner Herzog would talk about, you know?
There is a class
element.
You often
talked about the Rocky movies, Werner Herzog.
Herzog would definitely have something to say about these movies and, you know, the symphony of murder that is the boxing ring. But there's a really interesting class element in the contrast between training montages, I guess, in both cases, maybe more so in Creed 3, though. You know, there is a big difference between the guy doing push-ups alone in his, you know, very, very crappy, original Rocky-esque apartment, and the guy who has access to a private airport and a private plane that he can pull around.
That's true.
To show how strong he's getting.
But that, you know, to your point, like, that's another way in which he is like Rocky. You know, like, he's the one, to draw another connection, he's the one who's on the beach in Southern California, right? He's the one who's climbing up what, I don't know what he's doing, climbing ropes. I've never even seen a gym in my life. So it's, but he, like, yeah, he's the one who's doing the more Rocky-esque activities, you know, in that training montage. So yeah, it's another.
This feels like a fodder for like a circa 2012, 2013 hot take. Actually, Dame is the hero of Creed 3 internet piece.
I think there's also a kind of an interesting element in both of these films around the cult that forms around the enemy character, villain character, deutagonist, whatever you want to call them here.
Yeah, with both Clubber and Dame, it's like, where do these guys come from? You know?
And I think the really clever answer to that is success. You know, as soon as we don't really spend any time on how Dame gets from living alone in an apartment and, you know, training on the mercy of Adonis being willing to let him use the gym, to suddenly having a beach party full of hangers on. But it's just so easy to tell yourself that narrative. You know, he succeeded. A whole bunch of people wanted to party with him afterwards. Like, that's pretty simple. With Clubber, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, as soon as he started climbing up the ranks, he makes a big deal out of the fact that, like, he trains alone, he works alone, he doesn't need anybody else, but he still needs people, like, in the ring, you know, people to give him water and give him a rub down. He ignores the guy that is trying to pretend to be his trainer. He's like, you know, I don't need your advice, basically. But that's a common thing that practically everybody in the fight scenes in these movies do. The moment of your trainer tries to tell you something and you're like, no, I've got this, I've figured out what's going on, it doesn't really matter what side of the ring you're on, you're going to have that moment with your trainer.
You know, the side of the body, like that little soft spot in the little below the rib cage side of the body, that's where you got to hit. He's figured it out. He's figured out out where the weakness is. He's going to strike, and it's going to be all over. That's how it works. Or just hit somebody in the arm repeatedly.
I'm so glad that my work does not involve being hit in that soft place over and over and over by 400-pound men.
That's the classic spot for Rocky. Loves the body blows. That's where he gets. That's where he rattles people right at the foundation. He shakes the foundations by beating people in the abdomen.
Well, it helps when your opponent in all these movies appears not to understand the concept of blocking, not just doesn't block, but like doesn't. It's almost as if blocking is illegal. I think in Creed 3, it's a little better. And they do occasionally block, and in fact, like Jonathan Majors has this very interesting way of blocking punches that I've never seen. I'm not a boxing expert outside of Rocky, but. It's a little better in Creed 3, but yeah, like watching Rocky 3, it's like, do they know they're allowed to block the punches? Do they, because they just don't even have, they're not even trying. It's just, you know, well, there's a lot of like swinging wildly and people, and then, you know, the other guy going like this. Of course, this is a podcast, is an audio medium, but you can't see that I'm just whipping my head around.
Yeah. Again, when we're on YouTube,
yes,
this will be
another one for the YouTube version, exactly.
That actually brings up, I mean, it feels like we would be remiss in not talking about how these two boxing sequences compare with each other. And this is something I feel very much at sea in as somebody who's knows little to nothing about boxing and not a whole ton about sports ball in general. I'm curious how these fight sequences play to you, Scott, in particular, as somebody who may not be into boxing, but certainly is into like the back and forth of professional sports.
What I think of the boxing sequences?
And just the way they're shot. Creed 3 final boxing sequence with its very deliberate anime touches. I still don't particularly care for that moment where Adonis is thrown across the ring and he backs up into a wall of jail cell bars symbolically.
No, don't do that.
But it's really like the whole idea where the crowd falls away and it's just the two of them boxing in an empty arena.
That was a cool touch.
When you realize that the time has collapsed, so like they're now at round 11, right. It felt like a really good use of that kind of symbolic space.
There was actually some laughter in the audience when there was realized just how deep into the fight they were. Just like,
uh-huh. I love that.
I did like 11
so
rounds
much,
in.
And I'll tell you this: I know nothing about sports, but I do know that I would feel ripped off if I went to a boxing match and it was a typical movie boxing match where a bunch of punches are thrown and then somebody's KO'd in the first round, and it's like, nope, that's it.
Mike
boxing, you know?
those are like everybody would pay just insane pay per view prices to see Mike Tyson knock somebody out within like 40 seconds.
Glass
Joe was not like the strongest opponent for him.
I did wish that
these guys get to go at it for a long period of time. Like, I like the acknowledgement that we don't need to watch 11 rounds, but it does seem important that they spend that much time on it.
I did wish that they had filmed that like in Dodger Stadium. I mean, because to me, it did not look like they were two men alone in Dodger Stadium. It looked like two men alone on a soundstage surrounded by green walls, and they painted that all in. And that was one thing that I did, you know, like in terms of connections and comparisons, like, you know, the boxing matches in Rocky III. I mean, it looks like they're in a real arena surrounded by screaming fans. And in this movie, you know, it does look a lot of the time like they're on a soundstage and they've painted the backgrounds in. And I was just thinking, like, this is a really cool idea when it seems like they're alone in this place. But if they had gotten some helicopter shots or something that made it really feel like they really, like, we've done this almost like a magic trick and we've, like, they are actually alone in this place, I feel like it could have been even more powerful. I will say, as someone who I already said, you know, I'm not a boxing expert or aficionado or anything like that. But having grown up watching these movies, I was shocked when I watched a real boxing match for the first time. And it was not like Rocky, because I thought this was how it was. And I thought no one would be blocking. And I thought it would be nonstop excitement. And that is not what most non-Mike Tyson boxing matches are like. Actually, they're often nothing like that. The one thing I will say also in terms of the boxing in both movies that I always liked about Rocky and I do like about the Creed movies is that they always have, you know, recognizable figures or professional announcers doing the announcing, you know, like yes. In this movie, you have Stephen A. Smith doing, I think, a really good job playing himself in that sequence. Like they always, the Rocky movies, they always seem to take place in our world, in the real sports world, in a way that I think makes them just work better and feel more plausible and realistic, even when the boxing itself is implausible and totally stylized and over the top. Like the attention to those details, I think, does bring a lot to the overall kind of fabric of the movie.
Yeah. There's such a huge discussion to be had about what filmmakers want to emphasize in the way that they shoot boxing sequences. Because, of course, you know, with these movies, there is still kind of like a rooting interest thing. There's a thing of just like, we want to see, you know, our guy come back. You know, we want to see this really exciting, bruising fight. But then you also, you know, you want angles that you would be getting if you weren't, you know, if you're actually in the ring rather than outside the ring. There's that immediacy to it as well. But then you look at a film like Raging Bull, where all of the psychological torments in that film are carried over into the ring, and the emphasis is on violence and just, you know, and brutality, and it's not really about anything more than that, anything more elegant than that, or more exciting than that. It really is just about things being worked out on this terrible, violent stage.
The irony of what you're describing is that these boxing matches, you know, they're scripted like professional wrestling. And yet when Rocky III has a professional wrestling match, it is nothing like an actual professional wrestling match. And it almost seems like Sylvester Stallone thinks wrestling is real, which is funny because he also made and directed and wrote a wrestling movie in which it also seems like he thinks professional wrestling is real, which is Paradise Alley. It's very, very bizarre. He both seems to understand the sort of like the storytelling dynamics of wrestling. You know, we've even talked about like Apollo Creed turns face in Rocky III, which he totally does, and is so satisfying when he does it. In the same way, when that happens in wrestling, it's very satisfying when like a villain realizes the error of his ways and becomes a good guy. Like that happens all the time in wrestling. And yet when he does a wrestling scene like in Rocky III, it's just like bizarre, and it's just like Hulk Hogan manhandling Rocky and punching him and beating him up, and he seems to, there's no, apparently no script, and there's no plan, and it's nothing like an actual wrestling match, ironically.
It's exactly like an actual wrestling match. Paulie comes and hits Hulk Hogan over the head with a chair.
Okay, that part is, you're right, that part
pieces.
Is, you're right, that part is like a wrestling match.
Paulie, who we love, a lovable character, Paulie.
Everyone's favorite Rocky character, Paulie.
Paulie, come Why on, you gotta, he? he's, you know, he's just, he's the uncle at Thanksgiving that says horrible stuff, but you know he's part of the family.
If Paulie were still alive, his politics would be worse than Sylvester Stallone. Hey, one quick mini question for Matt more than anything else. I'm not as well versed in this as you are. To what degree was Rocky III responsible for like further popularizing professional wrestling in the 80s, or was this more of a convergence thing? Because I know Hulk Hogan was, you know, huge around this time, but it almost was like he got huger after this. I mean, huge in popularity, not 390 pounds as he is in this film.
Yeah, he's billed at 390 pounds. I think he's more like 300. I don't know how much you can give credit to Rocky III for wrestling, but you can absolutely give it credit for Hulk Hogan's rise, because he was sort of a guy who was becoming more famous sort of regionally where he was wrestling. And then I believe he was told like not to take this job, and he actually, by the wrestling promoter, wasn't Vince McMahon. I think it might have been Vince McMahon's father, actually, although I could be mistaken. But and he basically quit his job wrestling at the time and said, "I'm taking Thunderlips," and it made him an even bigger star. And then he went and wrestled somewhere else for a little while, and he continued to sort of grow in popularity, and that's when Vince McMahon brought him in to sort of be his new centerpiece and became like the Hulk Hogan that everyone knows now, with like the ripping his shirt and all that jazz, when he became sort of this like cartoon superhero wrestling guy for the that was more in the mid and later 80s. But yeah, this absolutely hugely raised his profile, because he was Thunderlips in the flesh, baby.
We'll have to get into to more of Hulk Hogan. We get into some of his classic films.
Yes, when you pair
on this podcast.
Yeah, when you tackle Mr. Nanny and pair that with something.
Until we do that, Rocky III is streaming on Netflix, Prime Video, Paramount Plus, AMC Plus, and MGM Plus. And if you don't happen to have any of those many services, it's also rentable on a variety of digital platforms and available on DVD and Blu-ray. Creed 3, you just see in theaters. I don't know what to tell you. Theaters nationwide. We'll be back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to recommend a film or film-related item that complements this set of episodes. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. I'm gonna throw it to myself on this one, because boxing film, and boxing, there's no question that, I mean, in my mind, that boxing is the cinematic sport in terms of just turning out so many great movies. Raging Bull, we already mentioned. You got a film like The Setup. There's one of my favorite John Huston films, is a film called Fat City. But what I kind of wanted to recommend, just for entertainment purposes, is a little film called Digstown from 1990. This is a Michael Ritchie directed film with James Woods and Bruce Dern and Louis Gossett Jr. It's a sort of a con man comedy, with boxing, in which James Woods plays a con artist who comes to this boxing town of Digstown that's run by this nefarious character who's played by Bruce Dern. And he comes to him with this proposition, which is that he will have his guy, Louis Gossett Jr., fight 10 boxers in one evening that Bruce Dern's character can kind of find within city limits to fight him. And they're both con artists in their way. And so they're both doing, there's a lot of trickery involved in choosing these fighters and in kind of how everything sort of plays out in the ring. It is an immensely entertaining film. James Woods is a tough fellow to feel for these days, but really at his best in this film, just is really sly and funny. And Bruce Dern is malevolent, and Louis Gossett Jr. is just kind of a much more, he plays a more straightforward character, but also is kind of in on the fun. It is a really hugely, hugely entertaining film that has is just so satisfactorily. It's just a film that was sort of orphaned, was not really that much of a success in 1990. It has been hard to find. It's available, but it's been hard to it had been hard to find for a while. But it's a film I always sort of treasured, and I know it's an Alan Sepinwall favorite too. If he's out, I don't know if he listens to this podcast, but I know he's also an endorser. Do you all know Digstown? Have you seen Digstown?
I have it. I've heard good things about it for years, so I should watch it.
Am I the only Digstown watcher?
I haven't seen it in a long time. I need to revisit it.
Heather Graham is in it as well, young Heather Graham. Well, anyway.
There's also a TV series, briefly.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, in any case, I'm telling you, if you're looking for some big-time entertainment involving boxing and con artists, and James Woods when he was kind of really good and somebody you want looked forward to seeing, then this is the movie for you. It's called Digstown.
I've got a correction to the Next Picture Show. Digstown, the TV show, was unrelated to Digstown, the film.
Damn it, Keith. You introduced an error into your Next Picture Show entry. Incredible. That's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show, but we'll be back next week. Keith, do you want to tell us about our episodes dropping March 21st and 28th?
For our next pairing, we'll be watching and talking about two tales of bloody, unrelenting revenge, inspired by the arrival of John Wick Chapter 4, in which Keanu Reeves' unretired assassin continues to carve wearily through skilled enemies from around the globe. That put us in mind of another tale of a tough guy out to right wrongs done to him, the 1967 classic Point Blank. Lee Marvin stars as a career criminal who is double-crossed by his wife and best friend and determined to balance the scales by retrieving the $93,000 owed to him, no matter who stands in his way. Directed by John Borman, the film brings a new wave flair to a classic pulp story and sets it all against the backdrop of California at the height of the 1960s. Then we'll move on to another borderline avant-garde action film with the latest entry in the increasingly complicated, always stylish, John Wick franchise.
For now, we welcome your feedback on Rocky 3, Creed 3, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Tasha Robinson.
I am the film and streaming editor at Polygon.com, and I am on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. Keith?
I'm a freelance writer for various publications like GQ, TV Guide, The Ringer, Vulture, and I do a newsletter with my pal Scott Tobias, who you might know from this podcast, called The Reveal. It's a reveal.substack.com, and by the time you hear this podcast, we'll be deeper and deeper into our ongoing series where we watch all 100 out of the Sight and Sound top 100 films. Special guest Matt Singer, where can we find you?
I'm writing over at Screen Crush these days, screencrush.com. My Twitter account is at Matt Singer. I got a book on Siskel and Ebert coming out in the fall sometime.
Yes, we're all very excited about that.
Yeah, that's going to rule. You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. You can find me at The Reveal with Keith, and you can find me at the New York Times. You can find me in The Guardian, Vulture, and other fine publications. You can find our absent co-host, Genevieve Kosky, on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky, and she is the senior TV editor for Vulture. Stay updated on The Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod. Get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Matt Singer, thank you so much for being part of this show. These are long episodes. We took a lot of your time.
I didn't hear no bell.
Your knowledge.
I didn't hear no bell. We're going the distance tonight. All 15 rounds.
You got that eye of the tiger there, Matt. I can see you the really hunger did. In your eyes. I can see that you're never going to get old because you're going to keep punching.
The sad part is I think we literally could have talked Rocky 3 for at least another hour, which is just incredible to think about. Longer than the film. We would have had a podcast longer than the film. Thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time. Thank you.